right. Thank you. Thank you for having me tonight. I'm nervous. My name is Emily. My name is Emily, and I am an alcoholic. Let's try that again. Hi, my name is Emily, and I'm an alcoholic. Hello. Okay. I'm also a neurotic. I also have OCD tendencies. I also am a people pleaser, and I also have some anxiety. So I'm kind of a hot mess, if anybody can relate. but it is an honor to be here tonight, all joking aside, and to be asked to share my story. This is my third time sharing my story, and it's wild. It's going to be a little different than the first two. My sobriety date is July 28th, 2022, and it took a lot for me to get to that day, and I'll try to explain that with more accuracy in what I'm talking about, but basically there was a lot of denial in me coming to fully conceding that I'm an alcoholic, right, and that my life had become unmanageable. It took a long time for me to get there. So I'll, you know, go a little bit into what it was like before. So I was born April 21st, 1982. I'm 43 years old. I grew up in the Santa Ynez Valley, not too far away from here. And I have a younger sister. So I was the one and only for 5 years. And then this other kid came along and took my, you know, shining light. And more attention was on her. And I didn't like that. I also didn't like the crying. And you know, about the time that I was 7 and she was 2, stuff at home started to get pretty rough. And for me, this is where there's not a whole lot of memory. There's some bits and pieces, but there's a lot of darkness. So I do remember, you know, making these little forts in my bedroom and setting up my like My Little Ponies and coloring and just trying to cope with what was going on in my household between my parents. So my parents were going through a separation and then it became an in-house separation, and that was really bizarre for me as a child, not really understanding what's going on. And what had happened is my mom was hooking up with my dad's best friend, who soon became my stepdad. So this was an interesting period for me. And around 11 years old, you know, at this point, my mom and this man, they married, right? The best friend of my dad, they married. And this is when I first had my first drink. I was 11 years old, and I distinctively remember the feeling that I had in that moment so vividly. And it was like, hallelujah, where have you been all my life? And I'm 11, you know, but like, this is amazing. And I was off to the races at 11 years old. By the time that I was 12, my mom and my stepdad purchased a home together, and my bedroom was on a completely different end of the house from theirs, and it was right next to the garage, and in that garage, they had a refrigerator, and in that refrigerator, there was a ton of booze, and so this was back in the day where Zima was a thing, for those of you that remember Zima, which is like spiked Sprite, basically, and I loved Sprite when I was a kid, so this was, like, perfect for me. They would also have wine coolers, you know, things that were very appealing to a kid, you know, that are, like, bright orange and pink, and, yeah, so that was great for me, because they were so involved in their own stuff that they weren't really paying attention to these drinks that were missing. Really at all. And then at somehow, some point, some way, I managed to get myself into the liquor cabinet as well. And I, like, at the clever age of 13, 14, You know, I would see what the levels were of the alcohol in these bottles, and I'd pour some out, and then I'd like put water back in, you know, so they wouldn't tell. They couldn't tell. Again, you know, nothing was ever said to me. You know, at this point, I'm like starting to steal cigarettes. This is back in the day where like the liquor store would have like the little display of cigarettes on the counter, and girlfriends and I, we, you know, I'm like 13, 14 years old. We would do like a, hey, mister, try to get someone to like buy us booze. And then like, we'd go in like a crew of us into the store, and we'd like try to, distract the guy at the counter so we could like, you know, steal some cigarettes too. I mean, yeah, you know, this is before cell phones and TikTok and social media. We were this, you know, kids on bikes and doing, you know, bad things, going down to the creekside, smoking cigarettes, drinking, and just getting into trouble. And this was, you know, what I did in the Santa Ynez Valley because it was very boring growing up there. And let's remember, too, I'm an alcoholic. So by the time that I go into high school, this is when I start blacking out for the first time. And I think it was a Mickey's 40 that did me in my first blackout. Sorry. Sorry, it's funny to me now, but so it was just what we did. The people that I hung out with, this is just what we did. We would get drunk and then later on high on all sorts of other things that we could get our hands on. And there was a lot of that going on at Santa Ynez High School in the mid to late 90s. Kids would be prescribed, you know, Adderall, but they wouldn't want to take it, and so they'd trade it. And like, I'd steal opiates from my stepdad because he had a back, like somas, he had a back problem, and so we'd be trading, and like, this was my world. And so school went down the tank. I think my GPA my freshman year was like a 1.6 something, 1.67. My priority was, let's get drunk, let's hang out, let's be social, you know. Yeah, I don't want to deal with anything else. I just want life to be one big party. I did used to play sports. I got cut from teams because of my grades, and that didn't help any, you know. Sports would give me some structure. But again, like, there was a point where I think maybe my parents could have had, like, a handle on it, and I say maybe. But then it just got to a level where, you know, I was just out of control. And I think I scared my mom to death, really. Towards the time that I'm 16, 17, I'm hanging out with a crew that, like, you know, we identify as, like, gutter punk. So I'm all in black, dyed hair black, spiky, you know, patches, like the dog collar, the spikes. You know, I just look mean and, like, don't F with me. I'm angry. So I know what was really going on. Sorry. When I look back now, right, I see someone that was really hurting. And I just want to hug her today. I want to hug her today, and I want to assure her that it's going to work out. It's going to be okay. Yeah, there was a lot of putting up a front, you know, because there was a lot of pain inside. At times, too, there was some suicidal ideation, pretty passive. I never tried, but I thought about it a lot. And so, you know, I managed to graduate on time. I had to go to night school, actually, because of my grades, but I did manage to graduate on time. And then I couldn't wait to get the hell out of this area. You know, the zip code therapy started pretty early for me. So anyway, I don't want to spend too much in this area, but I moved around a lot after I left the Santa Ynez Valley. And I hopped around from Portland, Oregon, to Monterey, California area, to San Francisco, to Key West, Florida, to New York City, and then I came back home. I came back to this area. So by this point, I have a college degree under my belt. I went and got a bachelor's in psychology in San Francisco. And if you want to hear more about San Francisco days, maybe we'll have coffee sometime. But let's just say I was 25, 26, and wow. When I say hot mess, I mean, wow. It's amazing that I survived with the situations that I put myself into. Pretty rough. Pretty rough, pretty hardcore. So thank you, God. Thank you, God. Yeah. So during my time in San Francisco and in the Keys and New York City, I worked as a server, as a bartender, right? I graduated with this degree and I saw what my entry level pay would be. And I said, no. I'm just going to keep on doing this over here, waiting tables and bartending where I can drink. I mean, come on. I can make a profession out of this? Wait, I can even take it to another level with wine and become a sommelier and be so, like, educated in wine and get paid and to drink? Oh, my gosh. This is a dream come true for this little alcoholic right here. So... I moved back to this area and, I pursued work in the wine industry and, I was also still waiting tables and I did that for quite a while, about 8 years. And you know, there's some other drugs and things that are a part of my story too. And I thought I'd left that behind when I left Key West. But towards the end, it came back up into my life again. Like it just, you know, and there's a part in the book that I want to refer to. Like, I thought I could control it. I really thought I could control it. And it was very clear that I could not. So this is when I started to get pretty scared. About 4 years ago, what is it, 2025 right now? Okay, all right. So 2020, COVID. My dad died August 18th. And while my dad and I didn't have the most amazing relationship, he was still my father. And it was pretty rough to be with him bedside. He was an alcoholic, major depression, not just suicidal ideation, but multiple psychiatric hospital stays. I tried really hard to be a good daughter and to help my dad the best way I knew how, but I was never sober. So it was, you know, not really my all, right? Not God's will. It was me just kind of in survival mode with him. So he passed away, and what do you guys think I did right afterwards? Went and got good and drunk, really good and drunk. My goodness, wasted on tequila. 6 months after my dad died, my stepbrother died. He was 44, he had colon cancer, and I was with him the week that he died. And that was pretty brutal, seeing just a shell of a human being so young with kids that are so young. That ruined me. And okay, I want to back it up. And sorry about this, because I am all over the place, but that's just how it is. Okay, let me back it up right there. At that point when my brother Ned died, I was trying to stay sober for 6 months. Why am I trying to stay sober for 6 months? Let me back it up a little bit more. I told you guys that I used to live in Key West, okay? I was 27 when I moved to Key West, and I met two amazing people there. Actually, more than two, but two that really stick out, because one of them is my husband, who I'm still with today, and the other is my best friend, Rachel. My best friend, Rachel. Sorry. Got this. Okay. And so I left Key West and we stayed very close. She would come out to California and visit me. She was one of my bridesmaids in my wedding. I would go to Key West every year to visit her. Like, this is my soulmate, my soul sister, you know, sister from another mother. Like, she just got me. And you guys know what it's like to have a friendship, or maybe you don't, when you're with someone who just gets you. It's really special. Phew, sorry. Okay. So Rachel, at this time, she had quit drinking. And she said, Emily, just try and go a year. And I was, you know, thinking like, she's nuts, but maybe I'll try this, because she had been sober for a little bit. And, you know, she was a drunk just like me, an alcoholic just like me. But she had some kind of spiritual experience, and the obsession was removed from her. And I saw how amazing her life had become. And to tell you the truth, I at a point didn't even want to see her social media posts, because I was so freaking jealous of my friend, who I love so much, at how amazing her life was, and she was sober, and I was mad. Whew. So my brother Ned dies. I at this point was, I think, 90 days sober. And that night, what do you think I did? Oh, I got lit. Whiskey that night. And then things just really started to go down. 6 months after that, my mother-in-law died. Oh, and I did not want to see another dead body. I couldn't bear it. My anxiety was just through the roof. Drinking every day. At this point, too, I had a surgery around the corner that I did not want to have, that only women would be able to relate to. It was a surgery I did not want to have. I did not want to have that part of my body removed, but it had to happen. So that was another loss, right? So I'm falling apart. I am falling apart. I'm 39 years old at this point, and I don't know what the F I'm doing with my life. I don't know who the F I am. I don't know what the F I want. I'm a mess. And alcohol is the only thing that can soothe it. Huh. Yeah. So I reach out for a therapist, because I'm like, I can't live like this anymore. I'm crying every single day. I'm having panic attacks. Like, I cannot live like this anymore. So I started working with a therapist, and that woman just, whew, she got me. And I come to find out, you know, well, she is one of us. And she knew off the bat that I was one too. But because she is so talented and she's been doing this for so long, she really let me get there at my pace, right? And I'm so grateful for that, because I wasn't ready before, and I was told before, you have a problem and, you know, kick rocks, man. You know, you don't know me. You don't know me. Ugh, just so angry. Screw the world, you know. You don't know anything. Oh, boy. But this woman knew me, and she took her time, and she was gentle. And there was a lot of healing that needed to happen in order for me to start really looking at my life square in the face, right, and seeing my truth. So I started studying addiction as well, because, you know, I'm one of those people who just, I don't know, I'm an overthinker, I'm an overanalyzer, I like to research, I'm a geek, I'm like that, and so I was interested, you know, like, what's going on with my brain? And, you know, like, remember, too, I got a degree in psychology, and it was more because I wanted to try to fix myself, right? Oh, yeah, I'm also the queen of all the self-help books, too. just avoidant, you know. So I am listening to a book by this woman. Her name is Annie Grace, and the book is called This Naked Mind, if maybe you've heard of it. And I go for a walk. This is July 28th, 2022. And the night before, I had been drinking. It was a Wednesday. By myself till midnight, And then, you know, it was so funny. I was like, my husband had seen that I had finished a bottle of wine that was like half full. And then I brought another bottle home. And instead of finishing the whole thing, so he, I kept like an inch left in the bottle because I wanted to say like, I didn't drink the whole thing, but it's like, it would have been better if I just drank the whole thing because then he wouldn't have seen that. Anyway, so, you know, but again, my thought process is all messed up. So anyway, the next morning I wake up after that and I'm like, I'm not hungover, but I'm just at this like total, like disgusting feeling of like, what the hell is wrong with you? Like, you seriously cannot stop. You can't control it. You need to go for a walk. Go take the dog, go for a walk. So I go for a walk and I'm listening to this book, you know, Audible or whatever. I get a phone call from a friend of mine and it was so random. She never calls me and she's like, Emily, I just wanted to check in on you. Like, are you okay? And it just came out. I said, Kelly, I'm an alcoholic. I need help. Whoa. What did I just say? And it felt like a relief, you know, as scary as it was. It felt like elephants or hippos or bricks. It just felt like they fell off of me. I could breathe, you know. That's what this is. I'm an alcoholic. That's what this is. I'm an alcoholic. Okay. Well, now what? Well, luckily, you know, I have a friend or, you know, a therapist who had let me, like, loaned her big book to me that I'd had in my home for a few weeks, maybe a couple months, actually. And I had kept it on my nightstand so that, like, the pages were facing out, you know, so you couldn't see the Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't want my husband to see that I had this because I'm still, like, really, you know, in denial. And, yeah, so... So I go into therapy that week and I'm just a wreck, you know, as you can tell, I'm a crier. And I was like, but what does this mean for my social life? What am I going to be able to do? Who am I going to be able to hang out with? What do we do when we hang out? How am I going to be able to go to my parents' house? Everybody drinks over there. How am I going to be able to deal with that? I'm freaking out. Freaking out. And she's like, whoa, 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 whoa. What are you doing this Sunday? Come to a meeting with me. Okay, so my first meeting was at the Santinez Alotto Club, or Solving, and it was a meditation meeting, and it was powerful, you know? I mean, those words, when they read from How It Works, it just hit, and it stuck, and I was like, I'm exactly where I'm meant to be. Why did it take me so long to get here? Whoa. You know, and of course I was also a basket case crying too. And because, yeah, that first few months, there was just a lot of locked up crap, just baggage, emotions, tears, trauma, stuff that just was never sorted out, you know? And I got to sort it out through AA. I got to sort it out with you guys. I got to start working these steps. You know, I got myself a sponsor. And I've been reading the big book. I pick it up and then I put it down. I pick it up and I put it down. And like when I first started my sober journey, I read the whole thing, you know, cover to cover as instructed by my sponsor. And I remember when I read this part, this is in, Two Wives, in the fourth edition, page 109, I wrote this is me. I is positive he can handle his liquor, that it does him no harm, that drinking is necessary in his business. Remember, I was a bartender and a wine, right? He would probably be insulted if he were called an alcoholic. Oh, yes, absolutely. This world is full of people like him. Some will moderate or stop altogether. Hello, I tried going on those breaks, and some will not. Of those who keep on, a good number will become true alcoholics after a while. He is remorseful after serious drinking bouts and tells you he wants to stop. But when he gets over the spree, he begins to think once more how he can drink moderately the next time. We think this person is in danger. These are the earmarks of a real alcoholic. Yep, bingo. Nailed it. You know, and the first time that my therapist, when she first lent me the book, I jumped straight to the stories in the back. I didn't read the first 164 pages. And I was doing the whole, like, I'm not that bad thing. But now I read it and I'm like, oh, yeah, yep. Uh-huh. Me too. So what happened, right? What it's like now. Okay. So I get sober, right? And it wasn't super duper easy, but the obsession was removed for me pretty quickly. I remember the first 2 weeks were hell during that like initial kind of detox. I was very irritable. I was very anxious and short with my husband. Something happened and I did like a whole, you're going to make me drink, you know, like shut up. And did some of that. There was one situation that happened about 8 months into my sobriety where I love this story. So about 8 months into my sobriety, I had just started my job at the hospital and I work in the emergency department and I'm a patient navigator, social worker. I help people that come in that are wanting to go into treatment. You know, I help our people. And so there was this one evening where someone came in and she was having a rough one and I stayed pretty late. Okay. I never called my husband to let him know what was going on. Now, when I was in the restaurant industry, bartending, living in Key West, living in New York City, I would go out with my coworkers after work and sometimes not get home until 3-4 in the morning. And my husband would be trying to call me. This is when we were just dating. But I was too drunk to, you know, let him know I was okay. And so this happened quite a lot. And he has some like PTSD from it, some trauma. It's a trigger for him. So I come home this night after working, you know, trying to help this person, right? I'm like, okay, I'm doing the good thing, right? I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. This is God's will. And he reams me and he's like, you're the same. Ouch. Oh my God. That was brutal. So I was like, wow. I was able to pinpoint that the emotion, the feeling that could take me out is shame. And I felt so much shame in that moment. It was excruciating. How dare you? But he was right. He was right. So I took my dog and I went for a walk. I'm always walking with my dog when I have these things happen. I'm walking down the street on Cypress and I always see this guy who's like always having a jolly time. He has his garage door open and he has it kind of set up as like a man cave den and he's always, you know, throwing back the Bud Lights. And so I'm walking and I have a scowl on my face and he's like, hey, you know, are you okay? What's up? I was like, no, not. He's like, I will go, come on over here. Come on, have a beer. And out of my mouth comes, I can't have a drink. I'm a fucking alcoholic, you know? And he just kind of made his face. And then all of a sudden, this woman's voice goes, wait. And she comes like running out. This woman, I've never seen her before in my life. She comes running out and she throws her arms around me and she says, don't drink no matter what. Don't drink no matter what. She's like, I used to be in recovery and I slipped. Don't do it. It's not worth it. Whatever you're going through right now, don't drink no matter what. Wow. HP looking out for me right there in that moment. Dang, that was powerful for me. Very powerful for me. So I went back home and, you know, my husband and I like had an adult conversation and I owned my part, which, you know, I needed to. And that's part of what we do in the steps, right? We own it. We keep our side of the street clean and we do that searching, fearless moral inventory of ourselves. So anyway, yeah, I love that story. So That was 8 months, right? Okay, so this point, let's see, I'm working my steps, and with the first step, you know, done, okay, sure, yes, absolutely, admitted that I was powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable. That was easy. Step two, came to believe in a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. That was evolving, you know? In the beginning, it was first kind of, I'm optimistic. You know, I believe in something. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but I definitely believe in a source, something greater, higher than myself. I don't know what it is, but it is a miracle that I'm alive today. So there's that. So I believe in something. We'll be open about it. Okay. Maybe I'll call it God someday. Maybe I'll feel more comfortable calling it God. But like when I first started, you know, source, spirit, the universe, I was, you know, one of those. And making the decision to turn my will over to the care of God. I still struggle with that because I have an ego, and I talk about it a lot in here. I process it a lot in here. And my ego, that's the perfectionist, that's the people pleaser, you know, it, and she will get the best of me, and I need to just put her aside. Put her in my pocket, you know, not let her run the show. And I need to let God run the show. And so this is a process for me, letting God's will direct my thinking. It is a discipline, right, that I'm trying to bring into my daily way of living. And it takes, for me, like, really dedication. And I do that with my prayer. So prayer, meditation, you know, that conscious contact that I'm seeking with God in step 11, that's playing into my step three here of constantly making that decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Step four, the inventory of myself. That was actually really, that was great for me. Because again, like I'm, you know, the psychology, like I'm trying to get to the root of stuff. Like, and I don't mind prying in and looking in at the ugliness, right? Because I really want to heal at this point, and I don't want to go back to drinking. So whatever I need to do, I'm going to do it. And my sponsor has a lot of wisdom, and she is able to guide me and direct me in what I need to do in this searching, fearless moral inventory, and I listen to her. Am I ready to have God remove all these defects of character? Oh man, I've been ready. Like, take them. You can have them all, you know? But again, it takes work because that ego keeps coming in the way. And so it's a daily, I see her popping her head up, you know, and I just gotta scoot her aside. Making the list, you know. So I just recently completed like the last person on my amends list. And it took me a while to get there. I was so scared. and it was, again, the ego getting in my way. Because I was right about this whole situation that happened between us, right? No, I wasn't. I was messed up, man. I shouldn't have done what I did. And it wasn't okay. But when I finally got a hold of her and we talked, it was again one of those like experiences where the elephants and the bricks and the weight on my back, it just went away. And there was this lightness that came over. It was that, you know, that sunlight of the spirit that came in, and it's just, this is why these work step if you, this is why these steps work if you work them, right? So, the spiritual awakening, I have them. They're hard to describe, the moments, but now I know it's God. You know, I say God now, and I really fully, firmly trust, fall, have faith in God. It is so wild. And I just think about this moment right now. Here I am, 3 years sober, at a speaker meeting, Alcoholics Anonymous, sharing my story. That's God. There's one part of my story that's really important that can't be left out. So, I told you about my friend Rachel, My friend Rachel, she died. It'll be 2 years tomorrow. I was 13 months into my recovery, and she had a brain aneurysm, and she died suddenly. And she was 1 month away from turning 41. Most painful event of my life. And I was sober. And I stayed sober. And it's only because of Alcoholics Anonymous that I got through that. I owe a lot to this place. I owe a lot to this program. I owe a lot to the people in this room right now. Thank you for being a part of my sobriety. Thank you for saving my life. And if you're new, Victor, just keep coming back. Okay, I think that's it.